Research shows stable housing during and after treatment of substance abuse and mental illness decreases the risk of relapse and helps to break the cycle of homelessness. Joining us to talk about how substance abuse and mental illness factors into chronic homelessness among individuals is Gene Carey, a director of the Homeless Outreach Team. He's also a certified alcohol and drug counselor. Good morning, Gene.
Morning, Mindy.
Also, Paul Hebert, who's the founder of Housing for All. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mindy.
And also joining us this morning is Ray Tomasi, president and CEO of Gosnold on Cape Cod, who ran into a little traffic, I'm assuming, just walking in the door. Hi, Ray. Good to see you.
Hi, Mindy.
All right. So last week on this program, we spoke with Rick Presbury from Housing Assistance Corporation and Greg Barr, a housing specialist with HAC, about the dismantling of the homeless camps in Hyannis last November. When the camps were dismantled, the inhabitants didn't show up at the NOAA shelter and were assuming they just moved to another homeless camp. For many of these individuals, substance abuse, mental illness, or a combination of both prevents them from seeking shelter and assistance. And Gene, I want to start with you. You work for FinFen, a mental health outreach agency. Tell us about how the homeless outreach team reaches out to this population of homeless and what it is VinFen does.
Okay, VinFen is a 2,000 employee organization. The particular entity that I work with is located in Hyannis. We have myself and two outreach workers that are full-time and a part-time LICSW on the staff. And the first step is always to make contact, because you never know when someone's going to be ready for that change. So you have to have that relationship. And that relationship can be based on a pair of socks, a bottle of water, a handshake, a cup of coffee.
Right. So you and your folks are out there, basically.
That's our job, is to not be in the office.
Right. And Ray, Gosnold provides treatment for mental illness and substance abuse. How often does your program see members of the homeless population, and how do you get those referrals? Normally people come to you and you know, ask for help, but some of these people who are out living in the woods somewhere, how do they get to you?
Primarily when they end up in the emergency room, and sometimes through police departments, but primarily through the emergency room. Okay. I mean, sometimes we'll get a direct referral from VinFen or from HAC or from the shelter, but
yeah, generally it's the emergency room.
Right?
And,
yeah.
As we said in the introduction, treating substance abuse or mental illness without ensuring the individual has stable housing oftentimes results in relapse. And Paul, can you talk a little bit about the program you and your wife Carolyn founded that provides that housing piece?
Well, at CHIP Homes, we do we care for people who have presented with at least 6 months of sobriety. That's not written in stone. I mean, there are some exceptions. But we've found to be successful, they have to, you know, show that they've been sober for some time. But recently, we just transitioned the pilot house programs into CHAMP homes. And what I like about that is the continuum of care. So somebody could be drinking as recently, drugging as recently as yesterday, and then present that they want to stop. Mm-hmm. And so through the pilot house programs, we're able to offer them the first step towards sobriety.
Right. And the pilot house, we should mention, that's pretty much the only place that somebody who is doing drugs or alcohol can go, right?
It deals clearly with folks that are presenting also as homeless. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's the only program that I'm aware of on all of Cape Cod that someone can be homeless and seek to end their addiction and get support in that process. Mm-hmm. And they all come in through the Duffy program, Duffy Healthcare. They offer the behavior modification. Mm-hmm. So they first present to Duffy, and then they cleared to enter the pilot house program.
And so that's an important piece there, because from the pilot house, where you're saying it could be yesterday, where they were, you know, using drugs or alcohol, then they transition, they get that 6 months, and they go into one of the other CHAMP homes. And maybe talk a little bit about why that's important. Why, you know, if you say 6 months, that's a pretty good time. Why can't I go home?
Well, the issue is that if they can't go home and they don't have a stable place or a good environment to go back to, the chances of relapse are more than great. Mm-hmm. So there have been people living for a long time at Pilot House because they know that if they go back to where they came from, they're going to simply end up relapsing. So we already have put in place the beginning of what we're going to call charter homes, if you will. There'll be sober houses, small sober houses, where they're going to know that they're going to continue to have support and be monitored. So we already have established one house that the folks will be able to move into, transition into. And so the community will get return on investment, if you will, and be more supportive.
Ray, that's a key thing when you've got somebody who's gone through a program like yours at Gosnold, and then they're ready to go back to wherever home is or wherever, you know, the community they came from. It's really important that you not fall back into hanging out with the same people and going through having the same habits, right? I mean, that's really, it's like the temptation is right there in front of you all the time. How do people deal with that aspect?
Well, I mean that's an issue for anyone, whether they're homeless or not homeless. Mm-hmm. You know, the beginning of recovery is cessation of use of the substance, but the sustaining of the remission for a person really involves, you know, a significant modification in all areas, almost all areas of one's life, because almost every area of one's life has been affected. Now, when you you truncate this down to the homeless population or the chronically homeless population, you generally, relative to it, to addiction or mental health, and many of them, of course, have co-occurring disorders, you're really looking at patients that are sort of comparable to a stage four patient who has some other condition. And in fact, many of these individuals, you know, there's a much higher incidence of other health problems. You know, they have higher incidence of diabetes, hypertension, cardiac problems. So they're compromised in many ways. And, you know, so the supports that need to be in place for individuals who have reached that point in their addiction and in their other life problems are substantial. I mean, you have, what, 110,000 chronically homeless people in the country, chronically homeless, you know. Those individuals consume a disproportionate amount of health care because they have many, many problems. So when you come to a treatment organization like Gosnold, we're a treatment organization, so we're treating a particular stage of the condition. And if it's a medical detoxification, that's, you know, the detox is essentially an emergency room for mm-hmm. addiction. It's, mm-hmm. you know, 4, 5, 6, 8 day stay, stabilize the person medically. And then it's a matter of trying to sustain that person in treatment. And when they have, even if they're in one of our programs for 2 or 3 or 4 months, you know, the supports need to be set up on the outside to help them sustain. I mean, frankly, with this population, I don't know what you guys think, but you're really, I mean, Paul's, you know, making reference to these sober houses. Well, I've always said for a long time, there is a segment of the population that will need to be in what I call, it's like assisted sober living. It's like assisted living for, you know, folks who are abstinent, you know, sustaining abstinence. But they're going to need supports probably for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you can come out of it, but it's without substantial and extended wraparound services. And even then, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to cure this. Mm-hmm.
Gene, you're nodding your head.
Right. It's a lifetime process. It's not an event. Mm-hmm. And so the 3, 4, 5 days, it's just a beginning.
Right.
And to be able to bridge that to get to the next step so that somebody doesn't think they can go back to exactly where they were. And it's going to be all right, because that's the illusion
mm-hmm. right.
that a lot of these folks have.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I think the issue comes down to also presenting them with some hope. Mm-hmm. And so we're very excited. We started a social entrepreneurial group. And key to this is to create some jobs that fit into the abilities of the people we're working with. So when I talk to these folks, they say, well, Paul, what's the point? You know, I get sober, but I have no hope for employment, even partial employment, and I have no hope for steady housing in the future. So we're working diligently to make that happen. So all the pieces are going to be there. It's not going to fit for everybody,
right.
but we're going to try to create greater hope for more people.
Right. We're talking about substance abuse and mental illness and its impact on chronic homelessness. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Gene?
I wanted to go back to a point that Ray was making. Within this population, you can't paint with a broad brush right. and get everyone, but there are individuals who've had traumatic head injuries. They have addiction issues, developmentally delayed, mm-hmm. and their appearance on the street is what would, you know, bring fear to someone. And so they truly are isolated from society. So to make that connection, get them the treatment they need. You have a traumatic brain injury, mm-hmm. You start drinking, smoking a little pot. Yeah. They set off. Now it's the police that are involved. Right. And so now you have jail, mm-hmm. courts.
Yeah, and you know, I think you guys can speak to this perhaps even better than I can, but I think one of the more troubling things that I've seen develop, particularly in the last few years, is that there seems to be a growing number of younger people who are sort of falling into this category. And some of it is because the severity of the problem and the manifestation of the addiction, if it's addiction, or their mental illness, if it's mental illness, is so severe and impacts families so severely. If families are like, they don't know what to do. So it's like, I can't do this anymore. You can't be here anymore. Right. And suddenly you got a 24-year-old guy who's arriving at one of our doorsteps, who's homeless, mm-hmm. who has not, at least, who doesn't have all of the sort of prototypical characteristics of the homeless person, of somebody, right. you know, sort of been homeless for 20 years or something. But think about what we face as a society. If you have somebody who's 24 who will inevitably drift into the subculture of mm-hmm. homelessness and all of that brings, not only is there someone who's sort of denied or unable to realize any kind of ambition or aspiration, but it becomes a long-term social right. cost problem.
And this whole issue of and mental illness, we don't have enough psychiatrists or enough, medical attention to really address the problem. You can see where some of these families get a little frustrated, and then, you know, what
That's
do you do?
That's not exactly true.
Really?
No, it's not exactly true. You have a bifurcated system. If you have the ability to pay for a service or you have a private insurance, you can get it. You can see a psychiatrist within 4 or 5 days.
Right. But if you don't have
have that, or you have a public insurance program, and many physicians don't accept public insurance, mm-hmm. then you end up on an interminable waiting list.
Right.
And the burden that's placed on organizations that have a community-based mentality, like us, if you will, are then faced with the tremendous pressure of having to try to meet the demand. And it's a very imbalanced system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a catch-22. You're homeless. You don't have a calendar. You have to keep 4 appointments with this therapist in order to see the psychiatrist. You miss an appointment.
Yeah, you're off the list.
You're off the list.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
So, Gene, what are the most common mental illness disorders that we're seeing in this homeless population? And I would imagine veterans are playing a larger role as they're coming home with head injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are we seeing?
There's a lot of bipolar. That's probably the number one. And again, drugs and alcohol are a way to manage that, self-medicate, if you will. The depression, anxiety is separate diagnosis, but certainly PTSD. And if for the homeless population and the veterans, you know, if this wasn't a trauma that was occurred in their youth, it's something they picked up in the more mature days. Women, Mindy, we were talking off air about the increase in the number of women.
Especially older women.
Older women. Mm-hmm. There's violence on the streets. Mm-hmm. These young people, they're a target. They're not used to being on the streets. They're naive. Mm-hmm. So when they get to a place where there are folks who are more wise in the ways of the street, they're a target. Yeah. They become victims very quickly.
There's no rules there in some of these camps. We were talking about that last week. This is, you know, anything goes on.
And so that PTSD is reinforced. And again, same thing, drugs and alcohol are that immediate relief.
When we're using the term substance abuse, we're talking about both alcohol and drug abuse. Is one more prevalent than another? I mean, I know we've talked a lot about the opiate addictions that we're seeing, so you know, growing here on the Cape and Islands. So are we seeing kind of both drug abuse?
Alcohol is still by far the most abused drug, you know, across the spectrum of addiction. I mean, you get 70% of the 25 million addicted people have a primary addiction to alcohol. And the opiate, prescription opiates and illicit opiates are certainly a rising trend and a disturbing trend because they're producing a disproportionate number of younger people who are being cast out because the requirements, if you will, what addiction requires an individual to do to sustain itself becomes very disturbing to families and to the community. And this is why, you know, you see a lot of the press reporting on these things with increased break-ins, because there's a desperation associated with addiction that demands a response. Mm-hmm. And the individuals, you know, frankly, are just being moved around by their addiction, and they're being compelled by their addiction. And when those social consequential events become troubling enough, families change locks on the door. They mm-hmm. tell them, you can't come here anymore. And now we have somebody who's out in the street who's you know, resorting to necessary behaviors to sustain that. And you're right. I mean, she's right. You know, they're naive to the ways, to mm-hmm. those ways. So the risks magnify. Mm-hmm. And then inevitably, those risks end up becoming realities for people.
Yeah. Paul, one of the things I want to ask you about is you're talking about some younger people, and that's it's hard to get a handle on, because some may be living out on the streets. Some are, you know, what they call couch surfing. They're going from this friend to that friend. And so they're really hard to get a handle on just how many young people we're talking about, right?
Well, when Champ Homes began back in 1990, we had estimated 150 across the Cape. In that kind of condition. And I don't know what the figures would be right now. What I'm more concerned about is the kind of the rising tide. And again, Ray and Gene could speak better about this. But my concern is that there's pretty clear evidence that using, for instance, marijuana, as you increase that amount, and kids starting as young as 12 and 13, 14 years old, that will affect them mentally. Right. So they bring on some of the mental illness themselves. And I don't think it's being addressed enough, so that kids aren't getting the message that you're not just entertaining yourself for Saturday night. You may be setting yourself up for a life of misery.
Yeah, it starts
suffering.
That way.
The,
Saturday,
the
right?
message they're getting is it's fine to do.
Yes, right.
That's
you know, Gosnell is being very helpful in that. I mean, the fact that Ray and his people have brought Chris the
Herring,
athlete,
yeah.
you know, that's starting to get the message to kids. It's you're going to ruin your life.
Right.
And so I thank
well,
you, Ray.
It's funny,
that.
As you were saying that, I was thinking of Chris, because yeah. Chris's story, I mean, he you know, here he was this amazing athlete. He was, you know, one of the Boston Celtics, as you know, other teams. And he started out with that kind of, you know, drinking on Saturday. It started out as a Saturday night thing, as Paul is saying, and it becomes this monster that you can't control.
You know, I'm telling you, I've been doing this for a long time. The other day, I went to the office. I had a letter on my desk. It was in an envelope. It was a handwritten letter. And I didn't have time to look at it. It was about 7 or 8 pages, handwritten letter. I took it home, and the other night I started reading it. It was from a 26-year-old girl who happened to be in the detox, and it was really a plea out for, please help me, somebody. And she's in the detox, college graduate, got hurt playing sports, mm-hmm. began taking pain medication. 4 years later, she's an IV heroin addict. She hasn't worked. Her family has pretty much closed the doors on her. She was begging for something. She didn't know where to go, what to do. There's no one left for her. I mean, I don't know how you can read a letter like that and not do something. I mean, it's just absolutely tragic, the lost opportunity. So she's with us, and I, you know, she'll stay with us. But I mean, if every person wrote a letter like that, you would be compelled, because behind this facade of, you know, what's wrong with this person, why can't they get themselves together, is a person.
Right.
You know, it's not about people purposely going out. Who really wants to be homeless?
Yeah.
You know, who wants to be caught in the cycle of addiction? But these are powerful forces that consume people, mm-hmm. and we need to care about them.
Absolutely. One of the things we do find with some of, especially the chronically homeless that may have mental illness, substance abuse, or combination of both, is they don't really want to come to these programs. They don't, you know, they'll say, you know, they want to be in the woods. And I know you run into folks like this. Do you just sort of keep coming back and hope at some point they could become ready? Gene, you sort of alluded to this earlier. It's like they may not be ready yet, but you want to be there when they are.
We had an opportunity with a fellow that wound up with Paul. It was he was in the woods for years down here. He had come down from Marlboro for the summer and never went back. And schizophrenia entered into his life, and alcohol, violence, trouble with the courts. And we would just leave a package for him week after week, and he really didn't want to talk, but finally he developed cataracts and fear. He couldn't see. Mm-hmm. And in order to get Mass Eye and Ear to do the cataracts, because it was significant, he had to have a place to go or they wouldn't do the cataract. They wouldn't operate on him. And so Paul made arrangements. He went in. He became a member of the Department of Mental Health, one of the clients. And now he's living, been years, mm-hmm. but he started at Champ Home. We needed that opportunity with him. Right.
So
he's maintained.
So that's basically what you're looking for then with some of these folks who are chronically homeless, is that opportunity.
Absolutely. The other part, though, Mindy, that I've gotten convinced with, one is a greater need for spirituality. I'm not talking about religion. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the emptiness that's in people that say, I'm going to experiment with my life, and they don't realize that. So there's a sense of both a spiritual looking at the importance of yourself, getting some hope in your life. Motivational speaking, apparently, is very, very important for people to say you have some other options. Nobody ever told them there was anything different for them to do or how they might be harming themselves. One thing that happened recently at Champ Homes is we had two young people go to the hospital for very minor things. I mean, it was a scratch, a bump, a cut, even some stitches. But they were prescribed narcotics. Mm. And so we didn't fill those prescriptions. They did fine with Tylenol or ibuprofen. And so we finally contacted the ethics member of the hospital and said, when somebody comes and they present that they're from Champ Homes, this is the list of the prescriptions that you can fill. These are the pain pills that are acceptable in our program. And I think doctors don't realize, for whatever reason, when they go the easy route, here, take these pills, you won't feel any pain, that you may be setting that person on a life of misery. Mm-hmm. And I just wish we'd stop and think as a society.
That's a really good point. We did a program a while back on chronic pain management, and I found it interesting, and I wish this doctor had said it on the air, but when we were off the air, he said, I haven't prescribed oxycodone in 4 years. And I was like, and this is a guy who manages chronic pain. There are so many different options. And I think that's a good point you bring up. Sometimes you'll talk to friends and they say, well, they get these huge pain prescriptions for something that you wouldn't think would warrant that. And the stories, and Ray, I know you hear a lot of these stories where somebody had some surgery and then they follow up with the pain. And it's scary.
I think there are indications of change. I mean, the prescription monitoring program will have some impact. But I know that, 4 or 5 years ago, we did a training at the hospital for physicians, and I think we may have had 6 docs there.
Wow.
Last summer, we did one in July and one in August, both on opioids, and the place was filled.
Yeah.
And so I think that, I think there's a greater sensitivity, partly because of, obviously all the problems, and frankly, physicians become at risk. But, you have to understand that physicians their objective is to alleviate
the
discomfort
pain, right?
And pain. And but I do think they're giving a little bit more thought. Well, we have the same problem. We send people to the ER and they come back with a prescription like they love it. Right.
They may not want to tell you about that.
Right.
Many of the discussions come to funding, Paul, and I'm looking at you because your organization raises all its own money. You don't take any state or federal, very little. I think there's a teeny bit of federal money
federal.
Yeah. And that seems like such an impossible task.
Well, I think we have to get real with the fact that the federal government is in trouble, and so is the state. And so we've always built our programs on the fact that we as local community have to start looking at these answers. So we're never going to be like a Gosnold. I think that we have to be the Minutemen. Mm-hmm. And so my programs have always been designed, look, we have no money, but we still have to do something. And it's down to neighbor helping neighbor with living in sobriety. And that affects different people differently. But I believe that it gets down to the very practical thing of we have to do something, and doing something is better than doing nothing. And so let's get on with it.
So it starts there. And then, and so, Gene, really, this is important to have the collaboration of all these organizations working together then.
Networking has been astounding. The St. Vincent de Paul, all these different folks, we pick up the phone and we have relationships. And they understand that when we say someone's desperate and they're in need, we need to plug in and take care of this mm-hmm. now. And they do respond.
Ray, I imagine you get more requests for services than you have beds for, right? I mean, what are there waiting lists for people? I mean, can people pretty much get in there if they need
to? For some of the longer-term programs, there are, because patients stay there longer. But, I mean, the emergency room or the detox, we're admitting probably 75 people a week there.
Wow.
So even if there is we sometimes schedule out a day or 2 days in some cases, but the objective there is to try to get the person in at the time of the call. You know, because there's an urgency associated with that call. Most people don't, you know, they don't call, you know, like 3 weeks ahead and say, reserve a bed for me. I mean, it's not that kind of thing. I think over the longer term, and what we're looking at now, we're going to roll out a program probably in May, depends on a couple of proposals that we're still waiting on. What we're trying to do is extend engagement with patients beyond the individual episode of care. You know, this is a chronic condition. Whether you're homeless or not, it's a chronic condition. And the real way to manage chronic conditions is to be with patients outside of individual episodes, so the detox or a rehab program or the recovery home program. So we're trying to get folks out into the community. We call them recovery coaches. Mm-hmm. We're using technology to streamline some of that, to accelerate communication. And also using some of the new medications that are designed to, you know, arrest cravings, particularly with opiate addiction. Not the opioid partial agonists. We don't like those. But some of the opiate blockers that are not mm-hmm. addictive.
Right.
And, you know, we're seeing some success with that. There's no one thing.
Mm-hmm,
there's
right.
no magic bullet to fire at this.
Right.
So.
And everybody's nodding their head. Leslie, we only have maybe about 20 seconds, Paul, but you brought up something that I just think really needs to be reiterated is hope. Really.
Yeah.
That is the big key.
Give them hope, and they can go a long way on that. But without the hope, they just get discouraged and relapse.
All right. And we'll have links to all your websites on our page, capeandislands.org, for folks who may want more information. Joining us this morning was Ray Tomasi, president and CEO of Gosnold on Cape Cod, Gene Carey, director of the Homeless Outreach Team, and Paul Hebert, founder of Housing for All. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.